Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth and Movies. I'm Layla Latif.
I'm David Jenkins.
And I'm Hannah Strong.
On the show this Barbieheimer week, it's the second of our two specials. This one is dedicated to all things Christopher Nolan's Oppenheimer. Plus, I got to speak to Cillian Murphy and we revisited 12 Angry Men. All coming up on Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. So, it's not been long since we were last gathered here. Very different film, very different vibe.
I wonder what order the listeners are going to listen to these in. Go and listen to the Barbie one first and then this one. Or if you just want to listen to one, I'm sure this one is fine on its own. And the Barbie one will be fine on its own as well. But if you want to do the T&M Barbieheimer double, do it in the order of Barbie and then Oppenheimer.
Yeah, because I hadn't seen Oppenheimer when we recorded the Barbie one. Not that I think it makes much difference. But I think it's better to listen to the Barbie one and then this one. And also because we talk a little bit about the strikes in that one as well.
Yeah. If you want to hear our two cents on the strikes, which are obviously super important, then you might want to jump over to the Barbie podcast.
Or just watch Oppenheimer, in which the power of unions is briefly discussed.
Yeah, it doesn't go so well for poor old Oppenheimer, does it?
But yeah, I mean, this is, I think I definitely did the actual watching in the right order, Oppenheimer and then Barbie, even if I suggest the podcast order be different. But yeah, I saw it on the big giant IMAX. I saw it in the Science Museum, which was incredibly cool. I try not to be that person that's like, you must go and spend the ludicrous current price of cinema tickets in order to go and see this, but I think if you don't see it on the IMAX, that would be a crying shame.
Yeah, I saw it at the IMAX in Waterloo on 70mm, and you know, I mean, all I can say from my relative position is that I very much appreciate, enjoyed that version of the film. I have yet to see it play on a normal kind of print or DCP, so I'm not able to judge. Although I will say, Just to play devil's advocate, that there have been some people tweeting about this because you know, I think a lot of people have been asking, oh, do you have to see it at 70mm IMAX? Because if you do, I've basically got to wait 3 weeks now. And people have been coming back saying, no, it plays just as well on a normal screen. But I mean, I guess for the sense of pomp and occasion that the film maybe deserves, then you might want to go that extra mile.
I mean, it is difficult in the UK as well, because obviously there's only three theatres in the UK that can even do 70mm IMAX. There's two in London, Science Museum, which is also where I saw it as well, as that, and South Bank. And then I believe Manchester has the other one that can do 70mm IMAX. So it is like, we're in a very privileged position to even get to see it in that format. It is a kind of, you know, most people won't be that fortunate. And yeah, then again, the cost of like 20 quid a ticket, if you want to take the whole family down to go and learn about the atomic bomb, it is quite expensive. I think, yeah, whatever way you watch it, as long as it's kind of not on your Apple Watch, then it's fine, you know. The thing I did like about seeing it on 70mm IMAX is that you could hear the projector, like in all the kind of silences in the film. And I think that the sound is something we'll probably talk about quite a lot. But when the theater went dead silent, you could hear that whir. And I'm a nerd who really enjoys hearing the projector when I go and see something projected on film.
What, one thing I would also add on that note, as a little kind of like teaser precursor to when we go deeper into the film, you know, talking of this subject matter, of ticket prices, and I mean, going to the cinema is not like chuck a fiver in a pot these days, you know. as it was in my youth a million years ago. You know, to take the family on a trip on the weekend is like remortgage, win the lottery, et cetera, et cetera. But like, I feel that like a film like Oppenheimer, I think what Nolan is trying to work to make that ticket price feel justified, and not just the fact that it's a 3-hour film, but there is stuff about it and there's stuff in it that it really makes it feel like there is that the added value is up there on the screen. You know, you're paying for this kind of slightly bigger, more ritzy treatment, but maybe we can go deeper into that in a while.
Yeah, I mean, this is in some ways like a very poor example of this, but I wonder whether there's a slightly like gendered thing when it comes to that whole see it on the biggest screen possible, where it's just like, oh, you know, it has to be like action movies, like films that that dudes like with really like big explosions. That's what the big screen is for. And like, we don't really say that about the Barbies of the world necessarily. But yeah, you can't deny with this one. You want to see the explosion real big.
I just think the gravitas of it all as well, like, and I think it's his best looking film. It's Hoyt van Hoytema, who's his regular Nolan's regular DP, and I mean, I think he's just one of the best, absolute best working in the game at the moment. I think his work on Nope was absolutely incredible. The Day for Night stuff in that film is just insane, and there was not really a need to do it, which makes it all the more impressive that they bothered. And in this, yeah, I mean, for a film that is like a lot of conversations happening, they make it look so cinematic. And I definitely think, like, even if you can't see it in IMAX 70mm, seeing it on a big screen, seeing it on film, like, it, you know, in terms of filmmakers working today, I think, as David says, like, Nolan's one of the ones who is absolutely trying to kind of push the boundaries of the format and innovate. And when everyone jokes about him kind of being a bit of a dad and a bit like kind of a purist, I think it's, you know, it's maybe not unwarranted, but at the same time, like, I can't help but kind of give him that, because I think he really does like have the kind of courage of his convictions. You know, nothing in his films is done via CGI if he can possibly avoid it, and I think that is like incredibly impressive in this day and age.
Yeah, it really does feel like incredibly rare and incredibly exciting to see something that is just so like dedicated to like that IMAX experience. I know he created new forms of film for it, and like, it just doesn't feel like a marketing tool at all. Like, some of these rather like cynically feel like, oh God, you know, this has to be seen at the cinema. This is definitely not coming from like a marketing department that wants you to spend £18 and then even more at a concession. Like, but yeah, there's a level of like respect for the audience, which, I mean, will never fully turn me against Nolan, even if Tenet happened. Fair. Yeah, we should get a move on to the actual film itself and stop dancing around what we actually thought about it. It's Oppenheimer.
Join our community of film lovers by becoming a Little White Lies member. You'll receive exclusive perks and an insider's view into the world of Little White Lies while directly supporting our independent film journalism. Search Little White Lies membership via your search engine and click through to our Steady HQ page for a detailed breakdown of the plans. Now on to the movies.
Oppenheimer tells the story of American scientist J. Robert Oppenheimer and his role in the development of the atomic bomb. We follow him throughout the decades, from being a young, anxious man studying quantum physics in Cambridge to developing the bomb and then becoming a target under McCarthyism. Before we get into the film, I spoke to Cillian Murphy about taking on the role of becoming one of the most important and conflicted men in human history. But like, I felt like texting my parents afterwards and being like, how on earth could you have me in a nuclear armament?
Wow. Well, I mean, we're still there. You know, we're still there. Yeah. Yeah.
And then I had kids, so I kind of did.
Exactly. Yeah.
But yeah, there's a break between Oppenheimer and his children. There seems to just kind of be this kind of something between them that he can't like fully connect to mm-hmm. them. Do you think part of that comes from this idea that he's sort of setting up kind of terrors for the younger generation?
I don't know. That's a very interesting take. I mean, I talked a lot with Emily Blunt, who, you know, plays Kitty, about their just seeming inability to connect with their kids or to parent in a natural way. And I don't know. I think they were both very, very ambitious. You know, I think Kitty's ambition was quite thwarted, you know, because she was a very modern woman living in a kind of not a very progressive society for women. And I don't know, I just think he was a very distant, kind of unknowable man and not a very natural parent. I'm not sure if he had the same reaction that you just had about, you know, how can I bring children into a world like this, particularly when I'm working on something that so potentially devastating. It's a good question. I don't know the answer.
It's just kind of interesting because he does have such an important bond with his brother Frank, so it's not like he's a kind of incapable of that sort of familial love.
No, it's true. Their relationship, again, sustained, as did his relationship with Kitty, sustained, you know. But he's very curious that way, you know, emotionally very difficult to pin down. And that was kind of part of the gift of playing him, because so unconventional as a protagonist in other films that I've played. He didn't follow any of the normal paths that you would have for a protagonist in a movie. But again, you try not to judge him. That was my key thing. He may not have been a great parent. He may not have been a great husband, whatever. But you have to try and understand why he was that and not judge or attach blame or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, when it kind of comes to him himself, like watching it, it did feel somewhat cyclical that like he starts off very lonely and despairing.
Yeah.
And then sort of builds this almost like someone refers to it as like a cult in Los Alamos.
Yeah. Yeah.
And sort of return to him seeming alone and despairing.
Yeah, that's a very good reading of it, I think, yeah.
I mean, is that kind of the tragedy of Oppenheimer in some way, that he was kind of always doomed to be misunderstood?
Well, I think that's why they call the book American Prometheus, and I think that is something very Promethean in his story and what happened to him and what happened to him in America in the 50s, you know. He was a victim of that. Of that culture of McCarthyism, whatever, in the States. And he, you know, it was very interesting when I was preparing for the part. It's in the book and it's not in the movie, but he always had this suspicion that something at some point would destroy him. And he was obsessed with this novel by Henry James called A Beast in the Jungle. And mm-hmm. I read the book and it's, you know, it's not one of James's finest novels, but it's a very interesting premise in that having this lurking suspicion that at some point something would destroy you, and he felt it all the way through his life, and then it kind of happened. And you can see him physically after the hearing in 54, I think it was 54, when he just became a broken man. He just went downhill physically, and he looked like he had aged like 20 years in no time at all.
I want to ask you about that, like physicality, because I mean, it's not just aging, is it? He kind of reminded me of like a Rodin sculpture. Like he seems to be like physically weighed down by everything that's come before.
Yeah, well, I worked an awful lot on that. I had like 6 months to prepare. And so alongside with reading and reading and reading, I was also then working on the physical thing, because it was, while I wasn't doing an impression, I wanted to use a lot of his physicality, because that was that iconic silhouette that we still recognize now with the hat and the pipe and the way the clothes hung on him. And he was very self-conscious about his physicality, how frail he was, but he had this incredible stamina. Like he would go out with Frank on the horses for 2 days and he would they'd only bring a bottle of whiskey and some chocolate, and they would survive on that alone. And he never ate, but yet, you know, his massive brain, how many calories must that have used up every day? I don't know, because your brain does eat calories. And so I was very interested in that. And that's why I wanted to get that frailty correct, you know, physical frailty.
I mean, a lot about this film like surprised me in the best ways. But one of them was that kind of connection that he had to New Mexico, because he's got such a longing to return. And then he kind of makes it the epicenter of all of this science.
Yeah.
But then towards the end, he's sort of willing to be like, oh, we'll just, you know, kind of give it back to the indigenous people. Like, how did you kind of view that relationship he goes through with it?
Well, it's kind of extraordinary, isn't it, that they decided, like, you know, they decided to develop the atomic bomb in New Mexico purely because he had a romantic attachment to the place, you know. And you know, I think that's very, very interesting that the movie deals with these tiny moments alongside these huge themes, like, you know, Strauss's destruction of Oppenheimer comes from what he thinks is a social slight. You know what I mean? That it's all built on that. I think that's really fascinating. And the fact that New Mexico will end up forever being associated with the Trinity test is because of, you know, Robert Oppenheimer's romantic attachment and love of that part of the world.
Like the science of it is fascinating because in a weird way, kind of something like time travel Interstellar, I was able to get my head around. And that's the crazy thing about quantum mechanics is that if you think you understand it, that means that you really haven't. And even like the scale of like the number of people that die at Hiroshima, like it's kind of too many people to almost for the human brain to take on. Like doing this for like, you know, as long as you've been working on this project, were you ever able to like really crystallize those things in your mind?
No, you do your best, as you say, but it's so kind of. It's genocide. You know, it's. I don't know if our brains have the capacity to really fathom it, as you say. But I think all of us, cast and crew alike, we're aware of the weight of it. We're aware of the subject matter. We're aware that these were real life events. And these are stories about life and death and politics and war and science, and they were big themes. But you know, we also had fun. You know, we also had a bit of a laugh making it. You know, particularly me and Emily had fun. You have to bring some levity to the thing, or else you're just going to be walking around in a state of, I don't know, despair, which isn't conducive to great creativity, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I just kind of assumed you had to be in a state of despair for all that time, because so much of it is kind of single shots of like just you very, very close. I mean, like, what is it like to kind of modulate your performance when it's going to be that close up and that intensely focused on like just the slightest movements of your face?
Well, first of all, in terms of the state of despair, I always work in a light way. I mean, I always like to have a bit of fun. I keep it like that because I wouldn't be able to sustain it otherwise. You know, and Chris is the same, and all of the ensemble, we were all kind of like that. And in terms of the close-up work, like, that's my favorite type of acting is to try to transmit emotions or information non-verbally, you know, just to transmit it through, you know, the internal workings of someone's mind. And that's my favorite. And doing it on with Chris, you get these huge fucking IMAX cameras like pushing in, and you're in there, make this terrific sound, or like as they're coming in, and so you really have to focus. And then of course it gets like played on these 80-foot like immersive IMAX screens, which Chris likens to 3D without the glasses. So, but again, you can't think about that when you're doing the work. You got to think about the kind of, I don't know. I don't know what you think about. I don't know. Talking about acting is fucking bullshit. I can't do it.
Yeah, there's a point where you just feel like you're dancing about architecture when you get into kind of like asking about the art, about the art, about the art.
That's it. Well, that's my favorite Frank Zappa quote.
But what, I mean, you've been doing this now for like, I think more than half your lifetime. Was there, I mean, kind of Oppenheimer feels like he was always fated to be, but like acting is something where you kind of have to make the active choice. But like, was there a moment? Was there like something where it all clicked and you knew that this was for you?
Yeah, I think when I started to do theatre, I wanted to be a musician and the music didn't work out for whatever reason. But then I found theatre, and theatre still had that live thing, and it had that great connection with the audience, and that I've always loved theatre, and kind of felt like I was at home when I started doing theatre. And then film happened very gradually and kind of incrementally, like small little parts here and there, and then slightly bigger parts and then bigger parts. So it's been a very healthy curve or graph. I think it would have been terrifying and unhealthy if I'd have been just catapulted into something. You know, so like you say, I've been doing it for 27 years now. So I feel like I'm still learning and still getting better, but that's what you always have to feel like, you know.
Again, I've been kind of changed on a molecular level by your performance in Oppenheimer. So, not that you weren't great to begin with, but I mean, is there a thing with acting though that there's like an element of like being given permission in the same way to like, oh, somebody told you that like this is what you should be doing. You're on like the right path, or is it just constant guesswork?
Totally, yeah, completely. And I think that any creative endeavor is like that. I don't know anyone that's got right. I'm going to start here, I'm going to finish there, and that's my goal, and this is my path. If you talk to any of these extraordinary actors that I've worked with in this movie, all of their paths have taken like crazy, unexpected diversions along the way. And you know, even the way I got to meet Chris, you know, I was auditioning for Batman and then it turns into something else. And, you know, it's so random, you know, and like Enda Walsh, who I worked with on Disco Pig's my first ever part on stage. You know, I've continued working with him for 27 years, you know, and we've just made a film together. So it's all kind of random. But I do think there is a constant of trying to find good work. And I'm really interested in challenging work and work that is, like I said earlier, that is provocative and presupposes that, like I said, like the audience are clever and smart and the audiences will be able to absorb this work, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, like as a movie fan, I just kind of came out writing a list of everything that I thought it was. I was like, it's 12 Angry Men, it's Threads, it's Dr. Strangelove, it's The Crucible. Like,
great.
Were there anything that you kind of like drew from? I assume you're a bit of a movie fan as well.
I'm going to use all of those movies you just mentioned. I don't know. I when I saw it for the first time, I felt strongly that it had horror elements in it. There was times when I was like, it was horrifying, but in a brilliant way. But I think he does that all the time. He kind of Trojan horses in other genres into his movies. And there's a big thriller aspect in it. The 12 Angry Men, that's really interesting. Particularly that last segment, we shot it in the last segment. It's interspersed throughout the movie. But, you know, the hearing in Room 2022, that's my favorite scene or portion of the film to act, because it felt like a piece of theater. We were in this outrageously tiny room. Like, it was not a set. It was a tiny, tiny room. And all these fantastic actors in this ginormous IMAX camera. And then every day, all these actors would come in. And sometimes I was just sitting at the back of that room, just watching these actors perform. And then sometimes I would have to engage and... It was incredible with, you know, one of the greatest directors of his generation there. So that was my favorite part.
Thank you so much. I mean, like, his use of silence and your ability to act through silence, just chef's kiss, as they say.
Nice one. Well, lovely
to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Take care.
Well, David, I've got to say, I kind of came into this and I'd heard this thing of, like, Nolan insisting that Oppenheimer is kind of the most important man basically that ever lived, and, you know, a little bit kind of raised eyebrow, like, were you convinced by that? Because I have to be completely like, yes, this was the moment where all of humanity changed.
I mean, not only does the film make you feel that and does a lot to convince you, there are a few moments where you have characters literally saying, you're the most important man in history, and lots of like covers of Time magazine and stuff like that. And I mean, to be honest, like I think that what it's saying and the way that I read it is maybe the most important man in history at that point, in that, you know, the film is about this idea of opening the Pandora's box of nuclear explosions and wondering, you know, if you don't open it, is someone else going to open it? And if they open it, what are they going to do with it? And I had trouble in a really good way of trying to describe the film to myself and actually to my wife when I was sort of telling her about it. I was like, I feel like it's not necessarily a biopic, even though it does have it's adapted from this very famous, lauded, very long non-fiction book called American Prometheus, which is a very detailed, but like it's sort of like a critical analytical biography of Oppenheimer and his work. But it does have this kind of undercurrent as well that's very political, very philosophical. And I think it, like, for me, it connected in a way that maybe some of the other recent Christopher Nolan films haven't done. Like, I mean, he's a filmmaker who is known, and one of his trademarks is this idea of having two stories happening at the same time, and you cut between them, and there is this kind of this sense of mounting tension as these stories kind of, you know, come to a head dramatically or sometimes even intersect. And that's a kind of move that he pretty much has in every film. And he has it in this film as well. But there's actually something a bit more like thematic about this film that's more satisfying, where he has like the narrative part of the film and the psychological part of the film, and they're the kind of bits that are kind of warring against each other. And I think tied together by Cillian Murphy, who is pretty extraordinary in the film. Maybe we can go deeper on Cillian, but, you know, I'll just say for, as a top line that, you know, I thought he was fairly astonishing, and in a performance that I maybe wouldn't have expected from him, like from seeing his other films. Like, it's got a real kind of gravitas to it, to borrow one of a word that Hannah used before, but it's also a very unshowy performance. It's not the big emotional thing. It's a very sort of tamped back and intense performance that I think is technically more impressive than him sort of wringing out emotions on screen.
Yeah, I thought he was just incredible. I mean, like, so much of the film is kind of single shots, kind of just one person's face. And, you know, with the IMAX experience, that becomes even more intense because, you know, they're huge. But Nolan, even with, like, a comically large ensemble cast, seems to have a huge amount of trust in each actor to sell their moment without much sort of pomp and circumstance, I guess.
You know, I actually found that the cast, for all the kind of memes and the jokes about, like, why is every single man in Hollywood in this film, I actually thought it ended up working really well, because when they were introducing people, it did give them this kind of like, oh, there's that guy. And even if you didn't necessarily know which scientist it was, you kind of remembered, especially if you're like me and you're just kind of a nerd for like actors, you're kind of like, oh yeah, there's like Alex Wolff, there's Dane DeHaan, you know, you kind of like having that association made it easier for me to differentiate between who all these different people were than it being kind of just like bit players. And I don't know how much of that was like a conscious thing of like, if we get people that audiences know a little bit, then it will make it easier, or if it was just kind of an incidental thing. But certainly, like, there's a moment where Casey Affleck's character, and I won't kind of say who it is because he has like a very kind of like chilling moment in the film, which David actually kind of had said to me before I saw it. He was, oh yeah, I thought Casey Affleck was really good in this very small part, and like the way he's introduced is kind of very unsettling, and rightfully so when you figure out his whole deal in the film. And I kind of had this intake of breath when like they kind of explain who his character is and like what he did. He's like a not a nice guy, but that kind of added to the experience and didn't throw me out in the way I thought it would. There's only one performance that I didn't think worked, which is Gary Oldman. I don't know who it was ever announced in the pre-roll, kind of who he's playing in the film, so I won't say anything, but it did like throw me out a little bit because his accent work is terrible. But aside from Killian, who I'm sure will come back to circle on, like him and Emily Blunt, who I think is also remarkable, like everyone is very much kind of like playing their part. I thought Benny Safdie did a really good job in quite a difficult oppositional role he's playing. And even Robert Downey Jr., who, like, I've not seen him do good acting in a very long time, and it was really nice to see him in something and think, oh yeah, like, there's the guy who was in Zodiac and was brilliant in Zodiac and is capable of turning around this incredibly charismatic performance that has this kind of like hidden undercurrent. And I think in some ways I was lucky I hadn't bothered reading the book, because I was genuinely shocked at some of the kind of revelations in this film and just kind of like the insidiousness of all these different characters. And you do get that sense of like, not only did what Oppenheimer and this project and the team of scientists working on the Manhattan Project did tear the world apart, it kind of tore the community apart. And on a kind of human level, it was very like devastating to see the kind of ramifications of the thing they created and kind of where it went from there.
I mean, I would concur with you on Gary Oldman. I mean, I think it goes a long way to say the casting is very fine, and like he Oldman kind of enters quite late into the film, and one of the reasons, and it's maybe one of the reasons why it's so jarring, is because everyone else seems so seamless and like they're not doing a kind of caricature, or, you know, like you get these films where you someone walks on and then another character will be like, oh, it's Bobby Kennedy, hello Bobby, you know, like
there's one moment like that where, in fact, involving JFK
but like that's the Oldman moment is kind of when that happens, and it's jarring because it's so different to everything else that's come before it.
I didn't hate it, I gotta say, because I think there's a sort of professional politician smarm that like it kind of almost that sort of it like reflected to me. And like I feel like Bill Clinton entering a room would have a similar level of like unsettling, this person is just a bit too on, you know what I mean?
Maybe. I think it's maybe distracting because obviously like Gary Oldman won the Oscar for playing Churchill, and I found it just a little bit like, yeah, it kind of took me out of what I think is like quite a quite a damning scene and could have been like quite powerful, I think, if they just cast someone maybe a little bit more suited. But I tell you who I did think was great, and I was really skeptical that he would be any good, because the trailer, I think, kind of set it up, like it felt like a bit like a Marvel cameo to me, was Tom Conti as Albert Einstein. I thought he was really good, like has this just inherent kind of pathos in that performance of being like this man out of time who is watching the world crumble and who Oppenheimer goes to for counsel. And I found their scenes like really, they kind of like tie the film together, the scenes that Tom Conti and Cillian Murphy have, these, it's about three different moments in the film. And I thought that actually, in terms of playing a figure who is like iconic within history and everyone can picture Einstein in their head, I thought that worked really well.
That is a very, very Nolan thing, isn't it? Like, Nolan is so especially in his kind of sci-fi films, he constantly deals with this idea of like future echoes and seeing what's happening in the future or in along these kind of different sort of axes of time and space and all this kind of stuff. And the way that kind of manifests in Oppenheimer is that you're basically the connection between Einstein and Oppenheimer. He presents it as like Einstein as being this kind of future version of Oppenheimer, and like, you know, although Oppenheimer doesn't necessarily know it. I mean, at the beginning, Oppenheimer's seen as almost slightly mocking of Einstein, saying that, you know, he stopped, you know, he came up with a theory of relativity, but then didn't want to like take it further. So I'm taking it further. And the film is essentially him understanding why that assessment is not a great assessment, you know?
And then I think there's a little, the tiny glimmer of then Benny Safdie's character being the next Oppenheimer, like in that he's obsessed with the H-bomb and like the potential of the H-bomb. And yeah, this kind of idea of history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme, that I think, again, like Nolan is very into. And I actually watched The Prestige after watching Oppenheimer. I watched it this morning before we recorded the podcast. And this film in many ways kind of, I think, is, people are going to compare it to The Prestige, because I think The Prestige is probably his best film up until now. I maybe, ask me in a few weeks which I think is better, but this kind of, it feels like you're watching a magic trick. You're kind of not only the creation of the bomb, which I think is kind of treated like that, and it very much works because sometimes, and you mentioned this in your review, David, Nolan gets really bogged down in the kind of quantum physics of it all, and that can be quite hard to digest as someone who doesn't understand quantum physics. So I was glad in this one they did kind of like not get too bogged down in that and just kind of allowed it to be this, these are the greatest minds of their generation making this incredible thing, and that is both terrifying and incredible, very much like a magic trick.
Focus more on the moral side of it than the technical side.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah, the kind of the story in itself is so knotty, both like morally and even like to comprehend how humans can build something like that, but also use something like that. I did find it like, I apologize for being earnest, but quite like awe-inspiring, just the scale of the story that he's working with, let alone the scale with which he brings it to life.
Yeah, I found myself kind of getting really moved by a lot of those like very difficult moral arguments. I kept thinking about that 1990s horror film, The Cube, where it's like actually nobody designed The Cube. And I mean, this is a much better film than The Cube, but like the kind of horror of it all is that like if nobody really takes responsibility for this, like we're doing this thing because other people might, and then we don't choose to be the people that like decide where it goes or where it's used. So like who really has, you know, you can kind of keep your hands clean because like you weren't really responsible for murdering all those people. You were just kind of a cog in something like larger themselves. And then that struggle that Oppenheimer kind of has, because he does become the face of this and he becomes the man that is ultimately responsible for something that he wasn't prepared for. I mean, I'm sorry, Hannah, this is better than The Prestige.
I love The Prestige.
I've got to say, I'm with Hannah on this. I remember doing a fairly recent full rewatch. I was really like, yeah, The Prestige is really great. I don't know how recent it is you've seen it, but it's like there's a kind of messiness to it that I love. That it's very kind of just swinging for the fences. And it's just wild.
I do think thematically they work so well as a double bill because they are about this like impossible pursuit of knowledge and perfection and forbidden knowledge. And like, how far are you willing to go in order to achieve this goal? And what happens when you achieve that goal? You have to live with yourself and live with what you've done. I mean, God, it's remarkable to me that like as a teenager, I think I was quite dismissive of Christopher Nolan films as kind of like, oh, they're like, you know, just quite dry, like action films. And I did enjoy them. I mean, I think Interstellar is a remarkable film as well, but I do think like getting into the kind of moral theory of like Christopher Nolan films is something that like, it was like a light bulb moment last night. And I was, I've got to go and rewatch all his films again now, because I feel like I've kind of not been thinking about them enough. And then watching The Prestige this morning, I found it a really kind of rewarding experience. And it is that like that alchemy that I think he produces between his like cast and the material, and not even in terms of kind of like dialogue, it's just like in terms of choosing hit, like with the story he wants to tell. I do think there's some ropey dialogue in this film, I have to say. He's not gotten any better at writing female characters, which is not to disparage Florence Pugh and Emily Blunt, who I think are very, very good in this film. But I feel like I'm being so effusive across this Barbie and Oppenheimer double bill, but like I do think like it's the first time in a little while that I felt genuinely kind of like, wow, isn't it great to be working in film at the same time as two like genuinely very exciting filmmakers.
Riffing on something you said, Layla, about this idea of like that it's very much a kind of, it's an ensemble film that's very much focused on the idea of like a group coming together and collaborating to build this thing. I mean, one of the aspects I really loved about the film as well is that as we were sort of talking at the top of the show, that, you know, Nolan himself is this kind of ardent cinephile, and he almost kind of fetishizes the process and the making of film and the prints and the projection and the experience. And, you know, I suspect he'd be like sharing his popcorn with Tom Cruise in terms of like being a kind of hype man for the cinema experience. But like, I feel as well that like possibly one of the things that, you know, appealed to him about this subject matter is that Oppenheimer's story is inherently cinematic, and the building of Los Alamos, this kind of set that is like where this drama is going to play out. And as much as Oppenheimer is like the guy who we're focusing on and listening to and watching how he's reacting, it feels like a very interesting, like if you kind of extrapolate it out from its literal reading, that it is a film about a filmmaker. It does feel like a kind of like a sort of Day for Night, or, you know, one of those kind of great films about a director trying to sort of wrangle and marshal people together and get them to kind of come up with the best results possible. And like a lot of the time it's not about, and I think this is what's interesting about the film, it's not about so much of it is not about building the bomb. It's about all the other dramas. It's all about getting the security clearance, getting people onto the set to do their thing that they need to do, having these conversations that are going to inspire the next scene, getting new voices in. And it's like, you know, I don't know if that is how Nolan makes his movies, but like, you know, I think you could see Oppenheimer as much as a film about making movies as it is about the bomb, as about a very literal historical drama.
We were joking a few weeks ago about Asteroid City and the fact that in Asteroid City that it's set just after the war and there are atomic tests going on in the desert by Asteroid City in is it Texas? New Mexico?
It's never specified.
It's never quite specified.
In the sort of southwest.
Okay, so obviously, like Oppenheimer is set predominantly in kind of New Mexico for large parts. And Rogan Graham, friend of the podcast, turned to me as they were arriving in New Mexico to start work on the town. She turned to me and said, "It's Asteroid City." And you mentioning about the kind of like reading of it as a film about filmmaking just reminded me a lot of that. And I think weirdly, it's like, everyone's talking about Barbenheimer, but like I think Asteroid City and Oppenheimer is maybe the kind of more relevant double bill in a lot of ways.
Well, my colleague Adam Woodward actually said to me yesterday, basically, Asteroid City is like Barbie and Oppenheimer. If you cross-process Barbie and Oppenheimer, you'd get Asteroid City.
This is the long read I want to read.
That's a galaxy brain take, and I really loved it, and I hope he tweets it.
We should definitely talk more about Emily Blunt, though, because I keep mentioning her and not really saying why she's so good in this. And she's an actress that I don't really think I've been that, you know, I mean, I think she's fine in A Quiet Place. I don't really like those films, so it's not, you know, it doesn't really matter to me either way. But I was very impressed by her in this film playing Kitty Oppenheimer, Oppenheimer's long-suffering wife, who is this ex-communist alcoholic and has kind of been, really been through it when she meets Oppenheimer and continues to go through it, and remains this kind of like pillar of like defiance and kind of doesn't really like stand for his continuing bullshit, but is like so integral to him kind of being able to do his job. And I think there's always this running joke about women in Christopher Nolan films and kind of either being dead or just kind of being completely sidelined. And I do think, like, again, like her role and Florence Pugh's role as Jean Tatlock, who's the troubled young psychiatrist slash communist who Oppenheimer is dating before he gets married and then has an affair with afterwards. I do think it's kind of still a bit of an ongoing issue, but I was very impressed by her in this film. I thought that Blunt did a lot with the kind of few scenes she has, and there's a scene where she's being interrogated in the Security Council, who are deciding if they're going to renew Oppenheimer's clearance, which sounds so dull from an outsider, but it is absolutely riveting in the context of the film. But and she's kind of really like going for it in this scene, playing this like this, you know, fragile woman who is a, you know, a long-standing alcoholic and like has a hip flask in her bag and is kind of like has been watching her life slowly kind of disintegrate while her husband seems to be paralyzed and just unable to kind of fight back, and she's willing him to do so and he never does. And I was very impressed by her here.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I just loved, what he did with this ensemble generally, because it's so laser focused on Oppenheimer and everything that he did. Like lots of the kind of broader context that you'd probably expect isn't there. And like something like Kitty, like just a few moments that she has that kind of just brings in like the devastation that this entire world is still feeling after the loss of so many people in the First World War. And it just kind of brings it in subtly, just to kind of add a little bit more to this world. And the same thing that happens with Einstein. Like, there's just a couple of moments about anti-Semitism and what is, you are aware, is currently happening in Germany and Europe. And I think that's what I ended up kind of feeling so moved by it, because it never felt emotionally manipulative. Like when we were bringing in those kind of additional horrors, it was just with kind of the smallest glance, and it wasn't ever to kind of, you know, it wasn't that moment in Dunkirk when the little boats arrive where you're just like, okay, I'm going with this. I'm supposed to be weeping now. Yes, okay. It was a bit more interesting than that.
I feel on that note that like a sort of, I guess, a general observation that even these smaller roles, like there is very little fat to be trimmed in this film. You're not going to get the kind of, oh, it's 3 hours, they could have trimmed an hour out. You know, everything is very, very kind of tight film. And I even think that I would be, you know, if they released a kind of 4 hour cut of it, extended cut, which I think they probably very easily could, I would happily go and see that, because I mean, you know, one of my kind of favorite problematic films is Oliver Stone's JFK, and you know, I kind of love it as much for the kind of just the rush of information and the fact that he packs so much into to sort of, well, I think the normal cut is like 2 hours 50, and then you have there's a 4 hour director's cut. And but yeah, you just want to kind of like, in the same way that you'd want to kind of have a really fat amazing nonfiction book and just keep going with it and delving deeper, this kind of does a similar thing. And like with those roles, especially with the two kind of women characters, yeah, I think in terms of like screen time, that, you know, they don't really compare to sort of the male presence in the film, but like the scenes they have are very, like, they're both like vital, they're both extremely important and relevant. And I think that what he's done with this film and the way, specifically the way it's been edited, is that everything has been included to have some connection to the plot or to the sort of like build up the emotion or the psychology. You know, he's never really doing anything just because he thinks, oh, we should really include that slightly kind of superfluous episode as a kind of bit of color or detail to his life, which is I think very opposite to Barbie, which we've talked about Barbie and it's great, but Barbie is actually everything is pure, like, discursive.
I'm going to be thinking about this one for a long time. Yeah, I'm going to say it. Nolan's best film.
Say it, sister.
I just braced myself. I was with someone to fight me. Should we get some scores on this? David, in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
Do you know what? I'm like, this is going to be a little bit weird, and I may be just talking to Hannah here, but you can listen into this. I've sort of done my review, and it's kind of pending because the embargo's happening in about an hour. But I think I might slightly subvert my scores on the back of this. Like, I think I get in the review, I think I gave it fours across the board because we didn't really get time to go into it, and it's like really, really difficult to discuss. But there, for me, I found there were some elements in the third hour of the film that I didn't quite love as much as the second two, and it kind of goes into proper spoiler territory to kind of delve into those deeper. So I don't want to do it, but like, I think it's to do with this idea of like, I maybe felt that like Nolan was slightly sort of deifying Oppenheimer. Like I felt, you know, that there is a sense of like he's maybe a little bit too protective of him, and that kind of took me out of the film. And like the fact that I think he needed to build up some antagonists, he needed to sort of build up some people who we could kind of walk away and say, okay, those were the bad guys. Where I think that the reality was, and I'm guessing how it's presented in the book is a lot more complex and less kind of, you know, black and white than that. So I'm probably going to go four and four because, you know, like Nolan, I love the idea of him, but I rarely get a kind of humdinger with him. Like it never quite lands with me since The Prestige, of course. but then I'd go for a five in retrospect because, like, yeah, I'm kind of gagging to see it again, and I'm actually like, some of the issues that I had with it, I feel maybe kind of ironed out or seen afresh in another screening. So like six in retrospect.
Anna, what about you?
I think it was a four in anticipation because I was just, I mean, I'm always excited for a new Christopher Nolan film, even though I thought Tenet was like just laughably bad. I had fun with it, but it was a bad film. And then a four in enjoyment because I think I think it's an incredible film, but it's also like a difficult film. And I mean, I am looking forward to watching it again, and I will watch it again, but also like I'm kind of dreading watching it again because it's a lot. There's a lot going on. It's a lot to sit with. And I think as well, like David was just mentioning about the third act and the kind of like the enemies that emerge and the kind of villains of the piece. And I do agree with that actually. And I think maybe that's what the black and white is for as well. It's kind of an ironic thing of like, oh, it actually wasn't as black and white as this. And I don't know. But yeah, I do kind of agree with that. But I think in retrospect, it's a five for me. I'm just so kind of galvanized by it. And I really can't wait to see it again.
I love it when we're in sync, but I do hate that it's going to look like I'm just copying you. Yeah, four, five. Yeah, I think it's one that sort of improves and becomes more impressive in the mind whilst you're watching it, particularly not having expected it to be precisely what it was. There was an element of just trying to like process what I was being given, and it was, you know, not necessarily enjoyable, a lot of it, but always incredibly compelling. And yes, five in retrospect. And I'm going to rewatch The Prestige in case I've been like accidentally missing out on how great that is, because I thought it was good. Like, but
the one thing this film could have done with was Michael Caine. That's the only, like, you know, that's the only thing The Prestige has got on it.
Michael Caine as Truman.
He would have nailed it.
Yeah. So next up for Film Club, we have Cillian Murphy's suggestion. It's 12 Angry Men.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Life is full of what ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
A jury of 12 men deliberate the conviction or acquittal of a teenager charged with the murder on the basis of reasonable doubt. Disagreement and conflict among them will force the jurors to question their morals and values. So yeah, I mean, the reason we're pairing this with Oppenheimer is that there is quite a chunk of the film which is, you know, him in this kind of very small, oppressive room having to kind of answer to a sort of legalish panel, and kind of his fate is being decided in this space by a group of men. And yeah, so I guess we're going back to the classic. David, this is kind of like, in some ways, the most uncinematic premise ever, just a group of guys in a room. Like, do you think it earns its reputation as one of the greats?
Well, I think it's a film that for me, I've sort of seen it a fair few times across the year. And when you're, I think it's one of those films when you're very young, it sometimes gets talked up in the kind of more mainstream film books as this classic, and, you know, certainly an incredible debut film by Sidney Lumet. Like, the fact that he was kind of come into that with these kind of incredible ensemble cast with like J. Lee Cobb and Henry Fonda and et al. It's impressive. I think it's sort of a film that is of its moment and of its time, I think. And it's sort of the way it kind of deals with the morals of the duty of a jury is quite sort of maybe a little kind of trite and obvious now. But like, it's still a very kind of fun, watchable film. And like, you can imagine sort of seeing stage adaptations of it and enjoying it on that front. And yeah, I think maybe the interest of it might be, you know, I watched it after having seen Oppenheimer, and yeah, you can definitely see why he mentioned it. I mean, perhaps the element of it that I think is worth mentioning to sort of emphasize the overlap is like how Lumet films and blocks the scene, and he actually manages to make a film which takes place in a single room across, I think it's 100 minutes, where you just have these 12 characters talking, and there's a sort of bathroom next door that some people kind of will go into and have a little side conversation. But yeah, I mean, it sort of operates as testament to the fact that you know you don't need these huge sets, you don't need, you know, cityscapes, and you don't need flashbacks, that all these kind of moves that we'd learned from like throughout the history of cinema, even as far back to the silent era, you don't need them to have a really compelling drama. I mean, the film is essentially just, I think it's more than its script, because, you know, it's about how that script comes to life, but the interest of the film and why it maybe is going to have this important place in history is that, you know, it is showing that you know these very base elements of performance and cinema can be used in this very sort of primitive way.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I've got to say, I'm surprised to hear that it's even 100 minutes. It kind of really whizzed by for me. There's such a kind of wonderful rhythm to the way that all of these kind of actors not deliver their own dialogue, but the way that they interrupt each other is sort of like strangely suspenseful as well. I mean, Hannah, was it your first time with all the angry men?
Yeah, obviously, I you know, I'm very aware.
Sorry, just a theme across Barbieheimer week, and now into this, a lot of angry men.
Less life or death stakes in Barbie, more kind of talk of death. But yeah, I obviously know about 12 Angry Men. I think it's kind of always been there and kind of back of my head. He's like, yeah, I'll get around to that eventually. So this was like a first real reason to watch it I've had, other than watching kind of parodies of it over time. I think it's become kind of one of those like films that is just part of your kind of public consciousness if you watch a lot of television and movies, and it gets referenced a lot. And obviously, like, I know who Sidney Lumet is. I've watched other Sidney Lumet films, but just not this one. So yeah, it was a nice excuse. I was even more excited when I found out it was only 100 minutes, because that feels like a genuine kind of treat in this day and age. But yeah, I mean, I greatly enjoyed it. I said earlier, like, I'm a big fan of like conversations in rooms films, and this is like, it's a very good example of that. But I think also the kind of ultimate hope really in the legal system is that you get like a fair trial, and it's a very idealistic way in idealistic film in many ways, because it's presenting this group of men who are able to kind of argue through reason and logic and eventual kind of understanding of each other their way to like reasonable doubt. And I sadly think that like it's not really how it works, and I think people are much more lazy than this film would have you believe. But it's, yeah, I mean, it's hugely enjoyable, and you can definitely see the reasons it is such a kind of like relevant choice for Oppenheimer, especially even like the kind of relationship that forms between Jura 8 and which was the other one, I forget the numbers.
Well, they all have kind of archetypes as well, and like all of their kind of social backgrounds essentially like play into their how they have kind of read the case.
Which one was it? The one at the end? Oh, it's 8 and 9. Sorry, I'm very bad with numbers, but yeah, the kind of relationship that kind of like forms between 8 and 9 and across this like however long it's meant to be, hours, I guess.
Yeah.
The time scale where they're working across. I just found very that there was kind of a nice parallel there between something we see in the tribunal that Oppenheimer faces, where one of the, there's three people who were judging Oppenheimer on his security concerns, and one of them is much more kind of like open to the evidence and kind of like giving him a fair trial than the other two are. And yeah, that seemed very kind of an obvious kind of parallel in my mind. But yeah, I mean, it's just also like to see acting where people are talking over each other, like you just said, and it feel really kind of natural and not like stagey always really impresses me. It's such a natural part of like everyday dialogue, like how you talk to people, that happens so commonly in real life. But I find even now it's like it's quite difficult for that to seem really effortless, and that's something, yeah, in the film, like even a film kind of what, 60 years old, that it felt like entirely kind of seamless. 70 years old,
57. 70
years old. So yeah. Nearly 80 years old. Oh, my God. Nearly 80? I don't know. 70 years old. Nearly 70 years old. It's just so riveting for the listeners. But yeah, no, I mean, I thought it was great. But, you know, I kind of already knew that going in. I knew that it would be great. And it's like watching a really good tennis match. You're just kind of like back and forth the whole time. And you're kind of like doubting yourself and like changing your mind and reassessing the evidence. And I did some kind of like reading around the film afterwards. And it's really interesting to see the kind of legal like analysis of this film and like how there's like people that have been influenced very strongly to go into law by this film. But also the kind of like idea that actually within the context of the film, there have been lawyers who have said, well, it's just very unlikely that all that evidence would be like not, would kind of lead to the acquittal. It's like there's a bit on the kind of Wikipedia page where it's talking about it in relation to the OJ Simpson trial. And yeah, I mean, I think that's just like incredible, the fact that this film has had such a like a large cultural impact.
Well, I mean, I agree that I find seeing it now that some of the stuff that Henry Fonda comes up with is very, very kind of, A, it's like why would any lawyer have missed that, and B, like, you know, he himself must have been like a lawyer to have actually, you know, known all those things or known to sort of bring them up. And yeah, a lot of it seems very far-fetched to me, but I still think it's like a, like, as you say, it's not necessarily about acquittal. It's about doubt. And it is, I think it's like, along with, there's an amazing Western called The Oxbow Incident, which I think came out of sort of roughly similar time. And both are kind of very good kind of anti-death penalty films. You know, they're, you know, just showing that how wrong it is to sort of take that action and not, you know, not being able to kind of reverse it, even if you're kind of like sure that you're doing the right thing.
Getting very political this week. So pro-union, we're anti-death penalty, don't love atomic bombs.
Anti-patriarchy. But I think that's all, like mentioning the kind of the death penalty thing, again, that like kind of ties back into Oppenheimer and this idea of like who has the power to kind of like choose life or death, someone else's life or death. And it's very funny, like the poster for this film, which I was looking at before we started recording, the tagline is like, taglines back in the day used to be so much more dramatic. So so for 12 Angry Men, it was, life is in their hands, death is on their minds. It explodes like 12 sticks of dynamite. And I think that's what they should have gone with for Oppenheimer as well. Just use the same one.
Oh, yeah. I mean, great week for movies. I mean, like, obviously, you know, there are some dark times ahead because, you know, late summer is not the time that you necessarily want to be doing this gig. But like, what a absolute treat to the kind of past 7 days have been. But yeah, I mean, if people have any time left in their lives, David, after watching Barbie, Oppenheimer, 12 Angry Men and The Young Gods of Rushmore, what would you suggest they seek out?
This is very, very different to what we've been talking about. Actually, maybe not so different to Barbie. This maybe would have been a better one for Barbie, but like, I have been watching via the whatever the Channel 4 catch-up channel is now. It used to be called 4AD, but it's not anymore. They have a load of American material from this like American company called Adult Swim. And I've just sort of been diving a bit into that, but particularly this show called Tim and Eric's Awesome Show, Great Job, which is from, as I think it was, there was about five series and they did it from between 2007 and 2013. And it's this very surreal sketch show. Each episode is like 10 minutes long. It's got very kind of puerile humor and it's using these kind of graphics that are kind of taking the mick out of, like, I guess sort of cable and public access TV in America, done by these two sort of kind of comedy double act called Tim Heidecker and Eric Wareheim. And I know I'm going to seem so late to the party for this, but I've kind of been a Tim Heidecker fan for a long time, but just never, it's more that I never realized I had access to this until quite recently. So, you know, discovering it while I was sort of like flicking around on this 4 catch up channel, I found it and I was like, oh yeah, I can watch this now, you know, 10 years later than I was maybe meant to. But yeah, very, very, very enjoyable, silly fun, and kind of the sort of antidote to the kind of very rich meal that is Oppenheimer.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to see it again, so I need something to perk me up, as Barbie did.
I'm not even sure I'd recommend this to anyone. It's so stupid and strange, but like, I kind of love it.
Hannah, what about you? What would you suggest?
Well, reckoning with the weight of World War II and the fallout of World War II, I would like to recommend a graphic novel. I mean, it's an old one, so I'm sure plenty of listeners will have heard of it, but I think it's more than worth your time if you haven't, or maybe you just want to reread it, and that is Mouse by the graphic novelist, comic book artist, legend Art Spiegelman, whose father was interned in a concentration camp. Yeah, it's this incredible history of his father's experiences through the lens of art's life and interviews with him about this period of his life, and the way it is kind of told is like the Jewish people are framed as mice and the Nazis are framed as cats, and it's just like very matter of fact and very funny, but also, yeah, obviously emotionally devastating. And I think about it all the time. I read it for the first time in university. I did a module where we were learning about how graphic novel can be used as a vehicle for autobiography. And yeah, it's a really remarkable memoir / graphic novel, and I think pairs very well with the conversations we've been having about time and about kind of memory across these two episodes.
I might have to give myself a week or two before.
Yeah, maybe don't go out and buy it just after Oppenheimer.
But yeah, no, that sounds amazing though. That I think like 12 Angry Men for you is like one that I have kind of always thought I had to get round to at some point. And yes, I will order it now. I'll read it in a couple of weeks. But yes, thanks so much. So if you've got thoughts on these films, you can email truthandmovies@tcolondon.com or tweet us at LWLies. Next week, back to our regular programming, and the horror teens are back to making some truly terrible decisions in Talk to Me. I'll be talking to director Nicole Holofcener about her delightful new comedy, You Hurt My Feelings, and we'll review the film. And for Film Club, we revisit Walking and Talking. Thanks very much for tuning in, and if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Truth and Movies is hosted by me, Leila Latif, and my guests this week were David Jenkins and Hannah Strong. The podcast is produced by TCO London and edited by Bob Stankus.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.